we our special guest in our Portuguese program on SBS Radio, the Australian journalist Catherine Bonella, just publishing her new book, Operation Playboy. A lot of it is in Brazil. This is the third book, is your trilogy on Bali, no? Cocaine.
Well, it's my third book in relation to cocaine and drug dealers. It's my fourth book. The first three were sort of a Bali trilogy, and this sort of breaks out. This includes much more about Brazil, Florianopolis, and Europe.
Actually, snowing in Bali, your previous book already had a lot of Brazilians in there, no?
Yes, it did, yeah, because obviously the cocaine comes from South America and the Brazilians are going to Bali, so they're the ones who I met and who are the sellers there, yeah.
How start your contact with Brazilians connected with the cocaine traffic?
It started from my first book, which was Chappelle Corby's autobiography, My Story. And I started going into the jail in Bali, Hotel Karobakan, which we nicknamed it. And in there I met a guy called Rogério, and he introduced me to other Brazilians, and I met Brazilians outside, and that sort of led to Hotel K, and they read Hotel K, they liked it, they knew it was accurate, so they agreed to talk to me, and that led to snowing in Bali. So it was basically, I had no connection until I started going into the jail in Bali, and that's where my connection started.
And at the time, many Brazilians there?
There weren't a lot of Brazilians there. There was one guy who was the most sort of overt, and he was actually involved in the whole sort of Playboy scene. And he got busted coming out of a place called Coup d'Etat one night and went to jail. And I think he ended up doing sort of 12 years. He was later moved to Nusa Kambangan, which was where the two Brazilians who were executed were too.
Let's talk about Operation Playboy. You've been to Florianópolis?
Many times now and spent quite a lot of time there, yes.
And there you were interviewing the cop.
Yeah.
As the media now is saying, publicizing our book, the hot cop, Hernando Calleron. He was the one who was doing the Operation Playboy.
Yes, it was his operation, yeah. Well, Operation Playboy started when Fernando Calleron moved to Florianópolis, you know, federal police, and he was on the border. He was moved to Florianópolis and he was chasing the usual stuff, you know, truckloads of marijuana coming up from Paraguay and that kind of thing. And then he started realizing there was, you know, a huge amount of money being made by little pills being brought from Amsterdam and high quality marijuana. And he started putting the pieces together and he realized that there was a lot of guys, upper middle class guys, who were flying from Florianópolis through São Paulo Airport to Europe and to Bali. And he discovered that over a period of a couple of years, and he made it his focus, especially when Rodrigo Goulart flew from Florianópolis and got busted in Jakarta and was on death row. That really made him think, you know, we have to do something. And so the police sat around and said, well, what will we call this operation? And because the guys were sort of all high-flying, highly educated families, a lot of the families in Florianópolis, you know, are well-known, highly educated, and the guys already had quite a lot of money, so from their families. So it was called Operation Playboy, and Calleron was the boss of it.
You did go to Florianópolis to interview him, no, Fernando?
Yes.
And also you talked to many operators and horses and Lord Drugs. I was very, very impressed with one guy who gave you an interview. And he recognized that he gave the surfboards to Rodrigo Goulart, who was executed in Indonesia later,
yeah,
for surfboards with cocaine inside. So tell us about this guy. How were you able to make him open up to you and tell you this story?
That was an incredible moment when he revealed to me that he had handed Rodrigo Goulart the surfboards that, you know, sent him down on death row and then execution. And we'd been talking for a little while and he was gradually gaining trust. Everything was recorded. I had a digital recorder. He was aware of it. He knew that these were interviews. And then during one of them, he just said, I feel like I have blood on my hands. And then he sort of, it was almost like a confession, and he hadn't really talked to anyone about it. And he knew it was all on the record and he never asked for it to be taken off the record. Or he feels great guilt, and he wanted to talk about it.
And his situation, he's free, so he's not in the police radar.
He's free, yeah. Now he's free, yeah. I don't want to give too much of a spoiler.
But anyway, I'm just saying, you talk to many guys with many important stories. Can you keep your sources? Are you not in under any pressure to reveal your sources to the police?
Well, Snowing in Bali was the same. You know, Raphael was one of the lead characters or lead people. They're not characters, they're real people Snowing in Bali. And there was he had a little bit of concern that the police would actually try to get information out of me, who he was, where he was. That's never happened, and I doubt whether it'll happen with Operation Playboy.
Catherine, how do you explain Florianópolis? Why Florianópolis is such an important place and creates so many mules and horses and all this new route from Colombia, Peru, you know, into the world? Why Florianópolis?
Well, that's the question that no one can answer definitively. I ask that question time and time again to the cop, Fernando Chiron, and to the horses.
It's a small city.
Yeah, it's a small
comparatively.
City. Exactly. So you wonder why. It's very small comparative to, you know, São Paulo or Rio.
Rio, Belo Horizonte, Salvador, whatever.
Exactly. But the answers that they gave me were basically that because they're in Florianópolis, they ask for less money to carry the stuff. If you live in São Paulo or Rio, you know, everything's far more expensive, so they were cheaper horses. There's a lot of, European descendants there, so they're blonder, blue eyes, so they sort of meld in with the crowd. When they land in Europe, they don't look so out of place.
Directly.
They just look like they're going home to Europe maybe, you know. And it started there, and they started using what we call horses, which obviously, you know, a horse is an upmarket mule who speaks English, well-travelled, you know, looks good, educated, whereas mules are sort of probably the peasants, you know, and that was their distinguishing way they spoke about it. And so I think Florianópolis was just, they started sending people there. They were smart guys. They were surfers, so they were adrenaline junkies. They were used to taking risk. And basically others who were already in the game would come back with great clothes, they'd come back with high-quality skunk or marijuana from Europe. And so it kind of caught on. They were their own best advertisements. And basically they'd say, can I go too? And then it was just, they'd start flying and then they'd decide, oh, I can do this myself. And they would then try and hire their friends to go so they didn't have to take the biggest risk. And Fernando Chiron called it their little firms, you know, kept growing. He actually called it a cancer, and that just kept growing and growing in Florianópolis because everybody knew everybody else. And so they were just becoming bosses and then, you know, hiring other people. But I spoke to some guys who I'd call the lords, you know, because they became big bosses. They were working in São Paulo, in Rio, in Brasilia, you know, in some Porto Alegre, and going constantly to Europe, to Bali. You know, they were hiring a lot of horses and from all over Brazil at that point.
You witness the lifestyle of those guys. What is the profile of those drug lords from Santa Catarina state?
The profile of these guys is they're very charismatic. Most of those I met are very good looking, highly educated. A lot of them are lawyers, or their fathers are lawyers, work in the judiciary in Santa Catarina. The guys love good-looking women, models. They're into hookers as well. They're not discerning in that way whether they pay them or not. But they all have gorgeous girlfriends. They love wearing nice clothes, spend a lot of money on clothes, you know, go shopping in Europe. And, you know, one guy would go out and spend tens of thousands on, you know, Armani and Gucci man bags and shoes and shirts. You know, they like the high life and they live for the moment, and they're adrenaline junkies. And most of them were surfers at Joaquina. You know, a lot of them were Joaquina guys. And then they would go to they would get so into doing the trafficking that would be their adrenaline fix. And surfing would sort of come second to that in the end.
So they are seekers of the dangers.
Yeah, for sure. Adrenaline junkies. I mean, even the guys from Rio, like Marco Archer, who was executed, you know, he's a professional hang glider. These guys, you know, they surf, they hang glide, they parasail, they paraglide. They love extreme sports.
And they use cocaine as well. How important, how big is the being an addicted or being a user? Take the guy into this path of a mule and horse and maybe a boss.
A lot of them, use it, but a lot of them are not addicts. Some of them I met were definitely addicted to it, and one guy in particular was, you know, said he was doing it for the addiction of cocaine. But some didn't use very much at all. It's the rush of the, you know, one guy described getting through international customs, borders with cocaine as an orgasm, better than an orgasm. Another guy said it's like being in a football field and having the whole audience screaming out your name. It's an adrenaline fix. It's more than an addiction to cocaine or an addiction to the cash that they get, because every successful run is like a lotto win, and but they do it for the rush as much as for the cash.
Catherine, this week you wrote about Operation Playboy, which is mostly about Brazil and Florianópolis, no?
Yeah.
You wrote an article for a newspaper this week in Australia. You mentioned that you interview one Brazilian that is detained in Europe. And to do the interview by phone, he was Jorge Brake. How could Jorge have a phone in a jail in Europe to talk to you?
How he described it was, I hired an ass, if I can say that on your show. But it's fairly common in jails. He hired somebody to hide a tiny little microphone, a telephone up his butt. And whenever he needed to use it, they would extract it and he would use it. But he didn't, the guy I was speaking to didn't ever do that himself. He hired an ass.
And how George was busted? How was his situation? How he was found and get into jail?
I have to say that I can't really talk about that because it's a spoiler.
Okay.
It's a spoiler. It's read
a
the
spoiler.
Book.
Read you the have book. To read the book to know yeah. the story.
It wasn't. What happens to George Brake? No one knows. It wasn't. Yeah.
So you were talking about this dream lifestyle, plenty of money, the best the world has to offer. Those guys they have, but when they are busted, they face death penalty, as we know, in many Asian countries, or they are detained and God knows. So how do you think they see the death penalty? This is not a deterrent at all.
Well, basically, after Marco Archer, who anyone from Brazil would know, he's the guy who was the first Westerner executed, and the first Brazilian ever executed, and the first Westerner in Indonesia executed. And he was sentenced to death by the court in Jakarta. And 8 days later, just 8 days later, they decided to send Rodrigo Goulart. So it was not a deterrent at all. But I have to say that I did meet some people during the time of the executions, some Brazilian drug dealers who were freaked out. And it definitely slowed things down a lot. And I think that now everybody is aware of the death penalty if they weren't before. So there is some sort of deterrent there.
And you talking to those guys in Florianópolis, you mentioned the death penalty. What do they say? Any mule or horse, you know they are risking going to Bali, you know?
It's a big risk to go
to Bali.
What
do they say?
No, well, I think some refused to go. There was one guy who I write about, who I interviewed many times. He went to Amsterdam constantly. He said, I was carrying bags more than anyone else. But when they asked him to go to Bali, he said, no. He said, it's like a big wave. You start paddling out, and if you're too scared, don't even paddle out. And he just said, no. Basically, didn't want to play Russian roulette with a firing squad. But some of them will take that risk. There's always, where there's money and there's adrenaline, they'll always find someone to take it.
Because you interview so many of them, not just Brazilians, but many in... You did a great job, Hotel Kerobokan, your investigation, and snowing in Bali. What you could see in those guys from this lifestyle here and finding themselves here, not just in the worst, but this is a horrible prison environment, corrupted and dirty, and what you could see the difference.
It's incredible. They live on such a high wire, they live such a high life. They live, on their hedonistic life. They can just on a whim get on a first class flight and go to, skiing in Europe or surfing in Bali, and they go to the best restaurants. They buy the best clothes. So for them, if they get busted, it's a bigger fall than the average person. So that's the irony, is they're doing this for the freedom of not having a ball and chain of 9-to-5 life and a routine life. They have freedom to do whatever they want. But ultimately, if they get busted, they end up with less freedom than the average person. So it's definitely difficult for them to deal with. But at the same time, there was one guy who I interviewed in a jail in Indonesia, and he could see a high-rise apartment outside the wall, and he looked at it and he pointed up and he said, to me, that's prison. you know, living a little flat. To him, he was saying it from the jail courtyard, but he still knew that, you know, he would get out, and he had all these years of fantastic high life, and he'd get out and he'd have the high life again, and he wouldn't, and his mind was freer than the people who were in this 9-to-5 routine life that they loathe.
Catherine, you have this unprecedented access, of course, the history of your books, and those guys, they trust you. They know your work, no? Have you ever find yourself in any dangerous situation?
That's a question I regularly get asked, talking to, you know, bosses, drug lords, you know, drug dealers, horses, mules.
Or you felt safe with them?
Well, I felt safe with the people I'm speaking to because they, I request an interview and I sit there and with a recorder and a digital recorder and they know what I'm doing. So I don't feel the only sort of sense of any threat that I've had is from people who hear that a journalist is exposing the world of drug dealing and they don't know what I'm doing. They don't know who I am, you know. So, but they're not direct. It's just something that I've sort of heard. So actually talking to these drug lords, playboys, adrenaline seeking, you know, very interesting, charismatic guys, and I haven't felt threat from them, no.
And Catherine, you mentioned Joaquina Beach, which is an important beach in Florianópolis in Brazil, in the circuit, international circuit of surf competition. Well, it's a small island, but it's 60 kilometers by 15 kilometers, not so small. Would you say there are any areas where they are concentrating where things happen more in the island? Lagoa da Conceição, for example. I remember Rodrigo Goulart was living in the Lagoa da Conceição.
Yeah, I went to his apartment, actually. The guy who gave him the surfboards took me on a tour to his apartment. Oh. I mean, Joaquina was where it all started. When I first started doing Operation Playboy, I touched on it. There's two chapters in Snowing in Bali, and that's when I realised that was a book on its own. And Fernando Chiron, the cop, took me to Joaquina and said, this is where it all started. And they were sort of the first. They were the guys, and that's one of them said to me, the reason that, you know, I think that we're tough at Joaquina, that we surf big waves, we're used to it, we're tough. And so that's probably the focal point, Joaquina. And in terms of Florianópolis, yeah.
Catherine, we have so many Brazilians detained in the Australian airports, Melbourne, Sydney, with 3 kilos, 6 kilos, 5 kilos. We had recently, well, last year, a couple from Criciúma, Santa Catarina in the south, a city in the south. Mm-hmm. A young couple in their 20s. We know they are from a good situation in Brazil. Detained in Australia, they are in jail here. What would you say for these Brazilians that are bringing, well, as you say, the horses, no? Mm-hmm. They are high middle class. Dozens of them arriving in Australia, which are a much safer country, but with mules and horses. What do you think of this situation?
Well, I think Australia is regarded as the prime target for any drug trafficker, especially cocaine, because it's the highest price on the planet. It's the best market.
It's
for
good
it.
Business.
It's great business. And with Brazilians, there's so many Brazilians living in Australia coming here who are not carrying. So the ones who are carrying can just sort of go in the tide and sort of get camouflaged among the tide. So that's why, you know, there are so many here and also all over the world because Brazil's home. They fly to Australia. It's quite normal. So it's not surprising that there's quite a lot.
We had one 19 years old young lady from caught this year as well, from Brazil, with I think 3 or 4 kilos. No? But 19 years old is like hard to understand, no, the situation.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a lot of horses or mules who get busted say, I was threatened and so on. That's from my experience talking over 10 years now to bosses and horses and mules. They don't get threatened. That's just an excuse they have when they get busted. They don't get threatened. There's a queue of people. When you're 19 years old, you're kind of bulletproof. So I think, you know, they won't get busted. They can live for a year on the money that they make. And it's just, so they take the risk. They take the gamble. And also coming to Australia, you know, there's less penalty than if you get busted in Bali.
Your impression about the super cop, Fernando Chiron?
Fernando Chiron was absolutely dedicated to catching these playboys. He's a straight cop. The judiciary in Brazil, the legal system from the cops to the lawyers, there's so much, it's endemic with corruption. He is a straight cop in the bent system trying to do his best, he said, to clean it up, to make a mark, to improve things in Brazil. And he spent dedicated a lot of time to talking to me and explaining Operation Playboy.
Catherine Bonella, just launching her book Operation Playboy, the explosive true story of the surfer playboys turned international drug lords and the cops who hunt them down. Thank you very much to coming here, talking to us. It's such a short notice.
My pleasure.